Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Well, have you ever thought about how your life could have been different if you knew then what you know now? Sometimes I think about that, especially as I watch my children grow up and want to impart my, of course, vivacious wisdom on their lives that they don't seem to want to know at that point in time. They don't want to accept it. But imagine how your 20s, for example, could have been different if you knew then what you know now. Would you have made smarter decisions? Would you have made wiser choices? Would you have made fewer mistakes? Wouldn't it have been great if we could just go back and try to live that again? How would your life be different? Or maybe you're in your 40s, 50s, or 60s, and you ask the same question about your 30s. Well, author and professor Kelly Worrell asked herself some of the same questions that I just asked. And what began as a series of articles on what I might do different when I was in my 20s. Let me try that again. Ted, can I try that again?
Yeah, this is just rehearsal.
Okay, let's try that again. What began as a series of articles on what she might have done differently in her 20s, Kelly Worrell then created a book with her husband, Peter. They are both professors and work with students all the time. So based on their experience and the questions that they've received from their students, they wrote a book called 20 Things We'd Tell Our 20-Something Selves. So let me tell you a little bit about them, and then we will get them on the show. Peter Worrell is an associate professor of education, and Kelly Worrell is a professor of communications at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Kelly has a Master of Religious Education degree from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and a Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing from Roosevelt University. And Peter, no slouch himself, has a Master of Arts degree in Biblical Studies from Moody Graduate School and a Master of Arts degree in Teaching from National Lewis University. He's currently pursuing a PhD in Educational Studies at Trinity as well. So welcome, Kelly and Peter, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So I tried to tell how you came up with this idea, but I think that you might do it better, Kelly. I didn't do it justice. How did you start writing those articles in the first place? What was that train of thought for you?
Well, I had a sabbatical from my teaching job a couple of years ago, and I headed into it actually intending to write a completely different book. Well, not completely different, but a different book that I was calling This Odd House. And it was all about faith formation. And I was blogging about it at thisoddhouse.org. And so I started with our childhood, actually, and was looking at, you know, what are the different factors that form us as a child that have huge implications for our spiritual journey, and wrote through that, different elements of that, and then got into, of course, adolescence and whatnot, the teenage years. And then I started to write about the decade of the 20s. And through that whole writing journey, I was using a lot of my own journey to tell about it. So a lot of it was through personal narrative. And so as I was writing about the 20s, I kind of whipped off a quick little blog post that I called 20 Things I Might Have Told My 20-Something Self. So it was even a little bit more cumbersome in the original title. And posted it on my blog, and my blog was pretty new at the time, and so for my blog, it got a lot of attention, and it was very curious to me. I thought, wow, okay, apparently these aren't just 20 things I wish I had known, and that I kind of learned the hard way through my 30s, but maybe other people, they're resonating with other people, and so then I sent it over to Relevant Magazine, and they posted it, and it did got a lot of response on Relevant. A lot of people seem to resonate with it. So then Moody Publishers actually came to me and said, we think this is the book that you need to be writing right now. And so it came to be.
And Peter, how did you get engaged as well?
Well, that's kind of funny because my wife went down, she had taken a sabbatical and so she was writing a lot. And then this opportunity came up when Moody Publishers circled back around and started talking to her. And she came home from one of those meetings and said, oh, darling, I need to tell you something. We're writing a book. And And being the loving and devoted husband that I am, I said, okay, then. And it's truly been a partnership, but it was something that I didn't really anticipate. And my wife's very gracious because in the writing together, she hasn't exhibited a lot of control or a lot of having to do things her way. It's really been a collaboration, which has been a joy, actually, for us to participate on it together. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you both share so many of your different experiences that contribute wildly to many of the 20 issues that you've come up with. So it seems that you've jumped right in, Peter.
Yeah, I did. Actually, my wife said that she knew I would come up with some ideas for the book because I tend to be an ideas person, but she didn't realize I'd provide so much heart. Mm. And I found the idea, quite honestly, to be quite cathartic. And so just like Kelly had gone through and examined herself and brought that before God, what I found is this was a deeply spiritual exercise where I revisited my 20s, which weren't pain-free for me, and then brought that pain and that growth that needed to happen and that had happened to God and grew in the writing process and learned to be more vulnerable.
Hmm. Well, I'm not going to go through all 20 of them, but I think it's worth starting with number one, examine your foundation carefully, because obviously it's from that that you've kind of stemmed everything else after that. So tell me a little bit about why number one was number one, examine your foundation carefully, as something you'd tell your 20-something self.
I
was going to say that with this, I teach a class called Faith and Learning, which is a foundational course at Moody. And that course, we had to build on a Christian worldview. And remember, this is at the Moody Bible Institute, and these are people who want to go into ministry, so they're the cream of our churches. And what I found is that they couldn't really articulate consistently a Christian worldview. And so many times when I raised what the components of a Christian worldview might be, I had a lot of students coming back to my office saying, can we talk about this further? I think my worldview's off. I don't think I've been constructing it properly.
Mm. And Kelly, you came up with some questions that we should ask ourselves in order to determine our worldview. How did you come up with those, and what was the result of that?
Yeah, the questions that are listed in the book actually were a result of an exercise that Peter did in his classroom, where he kind of, in that class, Faith and Learning, I think it was, he sat down with these students and they thought through, you know, if we're wanting to help people think about how they think, you know, what questions will we need to ask? And so they go through, you know, is there a supreme force, power, or being? And if so, what is it like? Is there a physical world, a spiritual world, or neither? Are human beings good, evil, or neither? Is there such a thing as truth? What do you value? Can logic be trusted? What books, people, or media inform your life? And then what happens when people die? And so the questions kind of work through the different areas of worldview, like epistemology, you know, your knowledge, understanding of knowledge, obviously your theology, your Christology, your anthropology, you know, what do you think about all of those things? So there are hopefully some pretty easy to comprehend questions, but that dig at some pretty deep things.
And you also, in that same chapter, just talked about how if we answer those questions and then look at where we actually spend our time and our money and our efforts, that has a lot to say about the answer to those questions. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there's a difference between controlling and professed beliefs. And when we go through this in church with 20-somethings, or when we go through this in a Bible college with 20-somethings, what happens is that people, no matter what their age, they want to put a good foot forward, their best foot forward. And so we get a lot of Christianese, pat, biblical kind of answers. And so to cut through that and say, okay, that's what you profess, that's what you would say when you've got your best Sunday clothes on. But now let's go to Monday afternoon and kind of go to a gut reaction of how you really think or feel. Is there any real evidence that you believe in God when you're working as a barista at a coffee shop? you know, is there any evidence that you value God above all things by the way that your bank account sort of reflects that, or the time that you spend on things would reflect that? And then reversing that, when you look at where you are at 3 o'clock on a Thursday, how does that then come back and reflect the value? What value is that? Did you pick that up from like a postmodern way of thinking, a consumerist way of thinking, or a biblical way of thinking? You know, where did that come from? And it isn't to point the finger and blame and shame and kind of feel better than each other. It's more of a confessional time to admit none of us really have intact the Christian worldview that we profess to. Mm.
Kelly, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I just think the importance, as we went through the whole structure of the book, and we start with the mind, we start with, you know, the first three chapters actually deal specifically with about kind of how we think, and just felt like it was important to start there for us to examine how we think. And then it moves into the middle third of the book. It kind of deals with how we live out our faith, the choices that we make on a daily basis. And the last third kind of deal with the heart and soul. And it was even after I looked at all of that and sat back and thought, you know what? The book is about how do we love God with our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And each of those pieces is so important. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it feeds into the rest of the book and the rest of the, what we hope people will be examining about their life.
So examine your foundation carefully was point number one. I'm talking to Peter and Kelly Worrell today. They both teach at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago and have authored a book called 20 Things We'd Tell Our 20-something Selves. We'll talk more with them and hopefully with you as well. If you'd like to give us a call at Connecting Faith, you have a question for our authors today, we'd love to take that in. 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. And we'll be back in just a minute.
Dear younger me, where do I start? If I could tell you everything that I have learned so far, then you could be one step ahead of all the painful memories still running through my head. I wonder how much different things would be, dear younger me.
Well, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Today we're talking with authors and professors Kelly and Peter Worrell. They've written a book called 20 Things We'd Tell Our 20-something Selves. We started with establishing a firm foundation, the importance of that. And now I'd like to get into kind of something that comes up against that, which is doubt. I'm going to read a short passage from their book. Peter had written, "When I was younger, there'd been a friendly air of inquiry when my friends and I talked about what we believed. But as I moved through my 20s, people of faith were more frequently marginalized, called morons, backward, or just plain ignorant. I didn't want to be any of those things, and so it seemed a lot safer to doubt." So, Peter, talk a little bit about that experience and how you began to form your opinion on what it meant to doubt.
Oh, yeah, actually, that was a hard time. I went to Pakistan as a one-year missionary on a short-term mission trip for a year when I was 18. And my doubt started when I encountered a Muslim country that was behaving better than I was. And so in my day-to-day running, I know we hear lots of bad things about Pakistan, and quite frankly, they're a little bit overblown. You know, there are pockets of violence. It's like the city of Chicago I live in. There are some bad neighborhoods here, but you wouldn't run down all of Chicago because of that. And Pakistan was like that. In my experience, I was there as a missionary, and I thought being a missionary meant outbehaving them. And so I was trying to be as nice as possible, and quite frankly, they were being nicer. They were giving me their last chicken that they had saved, and were giving it to me for meals. So that was kind of how the doubt started in my late teens. And then I went to an undergraduate school where I come from a conservative biblical foundation, which I still hold to now. But I was being taught by people in a Christian school, in a Anglican school, who didn't believe actually in a transcendent God. And my main lecturer was a lesbian Catholic. And it was she who, when I was trying to defend some of my ideas, just in an open forum, just shouted out across the room, "Well, you're a moron, and nobody believes that kind of stuff anymore." And would actually try to single me out in classes for my beliefs and just go after me. So that's kind of how the beliefs were challenged, and that's how the doubts arrived.
So why is doubt such a common issue, not just for 20-somethings, but just a common mm-hmm. issue for people of faith? And why is it not okay to doubt? Mm-hmm. How do you discuss this with your students, both of you?
Kelly, do you want to go for that one?
Yeah, I'll just say a couple of things. I'm sure you have more to add. But I think doubt is really common. I think partly it's the process of spiritual growth. I think partly it can be a healthy piece of, you know, the journey and a part of kind of owning your faith. And a lot of that does happen in our late teens and in our 20s, where, you know, our faith has to go from being something we were told to believe to something that we own and something that we can articulate for ourselves, something that we have, you know, has been tested and tried. And so when we talk to our students at Moody, you know, some of them do experience different pieces of doubt. It can look different. They can doubt different things about God and about the faith. And sometimes it's the very existence of God. Sometimes it's just his love for them. But we encourage them, I think, in part, not to ignore those thoughts and to articulate them and to acknowledge them and to enter into conversation with trusted people. You know, we try as their professors to be available for those conversations and to make it a safe place for them to question and to find answers. And you know, I think that's why we titled it Dig Deeper Than Your Doubt, because I think doubt is particularly dangerous when it goes underground and we aren't able to talk about it. And it can kind of grow and fester, and the emotions of fear mm-hmm. that surround it can become, you know, bigger than the question itself. And so we want it to be out in the open, to be talked about, and then to seek sources, to seek truth, mm-hmm. and to dig beyond, you know, the question mm-hmm. itself to find those answers.
Yeah. I remember reading about Lee Strobel saying that it was those mm-hmm. unanswered questions that really paved his path toward atheism. Right. Because he, when he would ask questions, when he would express mm-hmm. his doubts, he was told simply, well, you're not supposed to doubt that.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. We have a very simple faith that we've sold cheaply to our young people, a kind of easy believism, as some people call it. And you know, you trust Jesus, he makes your life better, and then you don't drink, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do, and then you die and you go to be with God in heaven. And that's kind of a simplified, easy believism that we've given to kids. And quite frankly, the research says that they realize that this isn't true by about age 13 or 14 anyway, but they keep going through as if it's true. And I like a quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who says, "I wouldn't give you a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity." And just to unpack that a little bit, it says, you know, I can say as a child that God is love. And then, you know, grandma or grandpa dies early in a freak car accident. And now suddenly God is love. That's simple, but it doesn't seem to answer this situation of my car crash. And sometimes in church, we steer away from these kinds of conversations, and the child sees that there's something amiss. But then if we push into the doubt and we ask the questions, we see somehow that on the other side of that trauma, on the other side of that difficult time, God is love, and it has a richer and more full meaning than it did when we didn't press into the doubt and we tried to believe it didn't exist.
Well, skepticism also seems to be a little more sophisticated, according to our culture, mm-hmm. than faith
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think we learn some of those lessons from culture, that exactly what you're saying, that, you know, it's cooler to be skeptical, it's more wise somehow, it's smarter, and that our faith does seem, like Peter was saying, so simplistic, that we can be told that is equal to simple-minded. But obviously we know that there's so much complexity and depth in the faith. And, you know, other messages from culture can tell us, you know, if we can't take it in with our senses, then it can't be true. You know, science is king. And so if we can't prove this scientifically, it can't be true. So kind of a denial of the supernatural. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is this element, it requires faith. It does require faith. And in some ways, faith is simple. But yeah, there's just such a depth in the faith that can be explored for a lifetime.
Well, and skepticism's kind of hip. So I do an exercise in my classroom sometimes where I have a student just say something that's really obvious, like the wall is blue. And I'll just look at them quizzically and I'll say, you know, are you sure? You know, I'm not so sure about that. And it's kind of funny how in the room we acknowledge it sounds like I'm wise. It sounds like I'm profound. But all that I'm doing is offering nothing to the conversation. And this is the kind of feel of our culture right now. It's an easy way out, actually, to not dig deeper and just become a cynic. Because a cynic can sound wise very cheaply, and yet they contribute nothing. Hmm.
I remember interviewing an apologist, and he said, "You just have to start asking the skeptic why they feel that way, why they believe that, and then turn the question back on them, and then all of a sudden you're the inquisitive one, the one with the sophisticated question." And I just thought that seems like such a simple way to respond to someone who's being skeptical of our faith, and I had never thought of that.
I like that. Yeah.
That's your exercise for next week.
Yeah.
So that's good.
We have a couple of minutes before our next break, but I would love to just talk a little bit about the people that you hang out with. Speaking of skeptics or people who would be supportive of your faith and your beliefs, why is community so important? One of the points you make in your book is choose your community carefully. Why do you suggest that for 20-somethings? And do you think that they heed that advice or do they know better?
I think some of them heed that advice for sure. And then, you know, others of us make unfortunate decisions. And I think community is so important for many reasons. One, I think, is simply, you know, we were created for community. When we were created, we look at Genesis and the fact that, you know, quite simply, it's not good for man to be alone. And so God created us to be in community. And so much happens in community. You know, our understanding of the world kind of is shaped by the people we allow to feed into that. And so both our understanding even of ourselves, our own identity, who we are and our place in the world, all is influenced, heavily influenced by the people who feed into us. And then our morals, you know, how we decide what is right and what is wrong. We learn that from the people in our lives. And then how we work out our faith, how we're going to live, the choices that we make on a daily basis are highly influenced by the people in our life.
We're going to join more in on that conversation about community, the people we hang with. I hear my mother's voice in my background, in the back of my head, as I'm talking about the friends that you make. We'll talk about more when we come back on the second half of Connecting Faith. Write that song. I think, does it say credits to Judy Bender?
For Amy Grant?
Yes. Thanks, Mom, for writing that song for Amy Grant. That was wonderful. This is Joe Bender. This is Connecting Faith. And today I have the pleasure of talking with Peter and Kelly Worrell. They teach at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago and have also authored a book called 20 Things We'd Tell Our 20-something Selves. And I have heard you'd better wise up and make good choices, I think, on more than one occasion in my life. But I found that maybe I should have heard that more times when I was in my 20s, because one of the things that I struggled with, and I'm guessing by the chapter that you've written, Kelly and Peter, that maybe you struggled on this as well, that the people you choose to hang around with really do impact the decisions that you make in your 20s that can impact then the rest of your lives. Have you found this to be true as well?
Yeah, definitely.
When I was in Pakistan, I actually had a good friend who was an atheist. He wasn't trying to convert me or change me or lead me into bad things. And so he would be an example of a somewhat neutral influence, but it isn't, that isn't the best kind of community. The best kind of community is the kind of community that has shared values and is pulling in the same direction. And this is where you have to ask yourself when you're choosing your community, do I really want Christ? Because if I'm choosing a community to spend most of my time with that isn't following hard after God, then maybe I don't want to follow hard after God, and I have to have a come-to-Jesus moment. Because I cannot really, right now in my 40s, when things seem very consequential, I can't spend my time, a lot of my time, with a group that's leading towards something that isn't that important. Yeah, in your 20s, you feel like you've got your whole life ahead of you, and so it doesn't really matter. But as life carries on ticking along, you realize that every moment and every time is precious. And you have to ask, what is this time? What is this group pulling towards? And if it isn't something that's God-honoring, if it isn't something that's moving in the right direction, then the focus needs to go back to God and to find a community that helps you to follow him and to walk with him.
Kelly, did you have a similar experience when you were in your 20s that it was you were having to make those kinds of choices for who you hung around with and who was directing you more or more toward or more away from God?
Yeah, I did. For me, I was really fortunate in my 20s with a lot of the friends that God put into my life. I was real involved in ministry at my church and was going to seminary and made some really significant relationships there. So, you know, there were choices that I need to make. I think for me, might have been the opposite, because I think what we're not saying is that you should only have Christian friends, you know, that those are the only people you should allow in your life, but we need them. And we need to have that place where we are being encouraged and spurred on in our faith. But we should also be reaching out to those people who don't know Christ, of course. But the question there is, mm-hmm. who's influencing who? You know, who's drawing who in what direction? And so to have that solid community that we can go back to where we can grow and then to be able to pour into people who don't know him and, you know, to hopefully draw them to Christ in the process.
One of the things I was reading about, I can't remember in which chapter you were writing about it, was along that same line of that sometimes you find yourself attracted to someone, attracted to the life that they have, and you'd like them to maybe talk about that with you. Maybe you could classify it as mentoring. Maybe it would be a little less formal than mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. I've found that it's really important to listen to that. Why am I drawn to that person? What is it about that person? Mm-hmm. And I will find mm-hmm. that 9 out of 10 times it's because they're living their lives in a God-honoring way. And that yeah. just must be a conviction of the Holy Spirit who's drawing me that way.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, because that's actually in Clinton's book, Connecting. And in that book, it says that attraction is a major part of mentoring. And it doesn't mean attraction like I find I want to go on a date with this person. It just means mm-hmm. that you have something in common. And you can actually form a good foundational mentoring relationship on car maintenance. Because you can say to somebody who just seems like they got a good walk with God, or somebody that you feel led to reach out to and to even mentor or to talk with them, you can say, hey, you know, how about if we get together around a car and we flip open the, I would call it a bonnet, you would call it a hood, and we work on that together. And you might find that that just happens once or twice. You might find it's the foundation to a beautiful relationship from which you're mentoring and learning from each other.
Well, and along the same lines of hanging out with people who are guiding you or teaching you to go the way that your heart would want to go, number 14 on your list is to take sin seriously. And so if we do get in a predicament where we're living a life that is not honoring God, we are to take that sin that we're to take all sin, but take sin seriously. How did you come up with that? And why in particular do you think that's especially important for someone who's in their 20s?
Yeah, I think, taking sin seriously is something we all need to do. It's not unique to our 20s, but I do think, at least from my personal experience, when I wrote the original article, looking back, that there were a lot of decisions I made, things I allowed into my life when I was in my 20s, thinking that, you know, it's not going to have any big consequences, I can deal with this later, and, you know, I'll mature out of this, it's fine. And I think going through then my 30s and into my 40s, realizing, you know what, those decisions I made did have long-term consequences, and they are affecting, you know, my mind even now, or they're affecting my marriage, and I had no idea. And so I think you have this perspective, I guess, when you do get a little bit older, you can look back and see some of the ramifications of those choices. And when you're in the moment, you don't have that vantage point.
There must be some kind of psychological reason for that, or that we are unable physically and mentally and emotionally to figure that out when we're making those decisions. I don't know what that research is, but there must be some.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't know the damage that it's actually doing, because we have been protected so far from the consequences. You don't have the immediate consequences of your sin quite often the moment that you do it. And so, you know, say, for example, there's gluttony. You know, at the first extra cupcake, nothing visibly happens, but, you know, 300 cupcakes later, suddenly the signs start to show. And these can be on things of immense gravity. And a band that I used to listen to in my 20s, they had a song, and the lyrics were, just when I think I'm winning, when I've broken every door, the ghosts of my life blow wilder than before. Just when I thought I could not be stopped, when my chance came to be king, the ghosts of my life blew wilder than the wind. And a couple of years ago, another band made a song called Ghosts. And when we get older, these decisions we made, these moments of sin that we engaged in, those come back to haunt us. And we can't feel that horror. We can't feel that when we're in our 20s making those initial decisions. All that we know is the moment of pleasure. All that we know is the moment of making that spot decision. But as somebody who's a little bit older, who's looking back, I need to say the Bible's true, that it's true when it says sin is sin, and that's a bad thing. And these things, you don't see the corruption in your soul, but it plays out in the future, and you don't want those ghosts, and you don't want those skeletons in your closet.
Well, and, you know, so many of your chapters kind of flow together. And with that, when you were talking about that you need to kind of settle into those decisions that you're making, you're looking into why you made that decision. You write that we need to look at that pain, that we need to kind of press into what is it that caused us to sin? What is it that caused us that pain in the first place? When I was in my 20s, I know I had this attitude that if people just hurt me, I just cut them out of my life. Well, that was it. They're gone. Goodbye. And I am finding now that I'm much older that if I would have just leaned into those relationships a little bit and pressed into that pain, that maybe I would have had a different result. But you do kind of think, well, there's a long time. I have a long time to make more friends. And so you just cut them out.
Yeah. I think pain is a big one. And, you know, I'm particularly passionate about that press into pain chapter. I think my own experience with pain was, that was when my doubt came. And it was past my 30s. It was into past my 20s, in our early 30s, Peter and I got married right at 30. And then a few years later, we tried to start a family and we experienced infertility. And that was the worst pain that I've had to experience thus far. And it was kind of in combination with the death of three of our four parents and just a really, really painful season. And it absolutely was a crisis of faith and just rocked me to my core. And so that's when my doubts really started to plague me. And so much, my life was just kind of falling apart. And so I've had to reflect a lot on pain and its role in our life. And I think you're exactly right. You know, we have all sorts of ways that we respond to pain when it comes, and we might try to ignore it, or like you're saying, to kind of get rid of it in whatever way seems possible, cut it off, get, you know, distance ourselves from it. We kind of medicate ourselves in various ways to try to not feel it, and so on. But I think the importance, what I've come to be just so fascinated with. It's just the role of pain in spiritual growth and how God uses that. And I've read a lot of different experts in spiritual growth, authors who write about the spiritual growth process, and all of them have that in common, that they write about the importance of pain and what God does in our pain and how he uses it, you know, to take us through and to take us to a deeper, if we press through it, to a deeper place with him, but only if we press through it, you know, not if we ignore it or run from it. And for a lot of us, pain does become that crisis of faith, and a lot of us, quite frankly, walk away. We're not willing to press mm-hmm. through it.
Right, and it's so important to do that in community. So it mm-hmm. kind of connects with some of our earlier points. You know, some people, if they press into pain and they don't have the support around them, then this can be a terrible experience, which they might collapse under the pressure. But one of the things when I found that my strategies of dealing with pain were awful, in my 20s, I experienced a lot of pain, dating pain and situational pain. And it got to the point where I just let my head take over. And I just tried to cut off my feelings. And because I like to think, I was able to do it to some degree. But you see, the feelings that you repress, the feelings that you push down, including your pain, it stays there. It doesn't go anywhere. It's not like I got rid of my pain. I just denied it and alienated myself from it and pushed it down. Mm-hmm. And Jesus would have wanted to heal that, but I wasn't listening to his voice on that issue. But it wasn't until 10 or so years after my 20s that finally I realized this was doing me no good. I was trying to stuff difficult situations, and it was coming out in my body and in my dreams even. My dreams were a little darker. And somebody said to me, you have to talk to somebody. You have to talk to somebody about the way you're dealing with your pain, the way you're dealing with these negative emotions. And I didn't want to. I really didn't want to, because I thought that's what people who are really messed up do. And if I talk to somebody about this, then that must mean I'm really messed up, and I don't want that label. So I resisted it until God really pushed me hard and I got over myself. And then I found that when I started talking to somebody, it was hard to stop, because there was so much in there that I had just denied and distanced myself from. And God started a healing process that I wouldn't have even imagined, but I had to stop denying it. I had to reach out into community.
So good. So, so good. We're talking to Kelly and Peter Worrell. They wrote a book called 20 Things We Tell Our 20-something selves, talking about what we wish we had known back when we were in our 20s, but it's certainly applicable for any age at this point, things that we wish we had known or could embrace now. We do have one of their books to give away. If you'd like to grab that copy for you or someone else, you can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Or if you have a question for Kelly or Peter, I'm sure they would love to answer that. We have just a bit more time on Connecting Faith coming up in just a few minutes.
See me now. I wish I could show you how I'm not who I was. I used to be mad at you, a little on the hurt side too, but I'm not who I was.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today. We're just having a great conversation today with Peter and Kelly Worrell. They've written a book called 20 Things We Tell Our 20-something Selves, and they're also professors at Moody Bible Institute. And Peter and Kelly, one question I seem to hear from college students and even some teenagers is, how do I know what God wants me to do with my life? Is that a question mm-hmm. that has come up in your dealings with the students as well? And how do you lead them through that?
Oh, yeah,
the question we get a lot, too. Yeah. A couple of things I try to help them understand is, number one, we don't have to know the entire future. Like, I know, I remember having conversations with my mom and different mentors when I was in high school and college. I just want to know the whole rest of my life and what it's going to be like. And, you know, just that truth that you don't have to know the whole plan. And you're not going to know the whole plan. So we need to become okay with that. But God, he just is able to, and he does so faithfully, you know, shine a light on our next footstep. And that's what we ought to be seeking from him. What's the next footstep? And then I think, too, you know, we have this idea of God that somehow he hides his will from us. That somehow it's this, you know, big guessing game, and he's got it hidden, and he has some, you know, sadistic pleasure in keeping it from us. And that's not the God I know. You know, the God I know wants to reveal himself to me and does in good time. It just doesn't always look like what I think it's supposed to look like, or the timing isn't what I think it's supposed to look like. But he's more than able to guide my step to the next, you know, the next rock, the next placement of my foot. And he does that so faithfully.
I was in Pakistan speaking to a missionary called Mr. Haikkanen, and he took out a Bible because I was talking to him about the will of God and how to discern the will of God. And he said, well, the problem with you people in England and America, he said, you view the will of God like this. And he held his Bible with the spine up, if you can picture that, and the pages hanging down. And he said, it's like you're trying to walk along the spine of the Bible, and that when you slide off, you're gone. Everything works towards pulling you away from the will of God, and you're done. And he said, the way we view it, and he flipped his Bible over so that the spine was down and the pages were up and pointing down in a V shape towards the middle. He said, you know, we view it that God loves us and that we commit our path to the Lord, and then we move and we follow him. And then God reveals his will to us by pulling us and pushing us back onto that path because he loves us and cares for us. And I think that dovetails with what Kelly was saying. A lot of our desire and our anxiety to know the will of God and discern it is because of the kind of God who we think we're trying to satisfy. And if you formed a relationship with God, the same God who loves us so much that he didn't even spare his own son to reconcile us to himself, you know, how much more is he going to delight in giving us signs and giving us indications of what he wants from us? And the Bible many times says, you know, here's the will of God, and it's to live rightly and to do justice to people and to walk with God and to pray. And, you know, focus on those things first, and then who you should marry and which mission organization you should join and where you're going to be in 20 years' time. Those things will fall into place, but that's not the first thing. The first thing is the will of God to know him and to be with him and enjoy him forever.
Well, and that's good advice, no matter if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, or whatever age, to be knowing him and striving to know him above all else, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And I've found, you know, just I think as you look in Scripture and how God calls people and how he draws people and moves people, and then just from my own experience, too, I think he's more than able to close the doors. You know, I think as we check his word and we check against his character and we make decisions and we move forward in something, he's more than able to redirect our paths. I mean, Peter and I have seen that over and over. You know, like, all right, God, we're going to trust you. You know, a few years ago, we felt like we were supposed to sell our house and move to a different city. And so we put our house on the market and trusting God that if we were supposed to move, and we thought there's every indication that our house should sell. It's a nice home and so on. And it didn't. And so it was kind of, well, okay, God, the clear closed door. And now 3 years later, we're feeling like he's calling us to something else. And it makes so much sense now why it didn't sell then. Then it was a bit confusing, and we just have to trust that he knows what he's doing. And you know, you see sometimes you get the pleasure of seeing after the fact what he was doing all along.
Well, and you write about being patient, and it seems like that question of what is the will, where is it, why can't I find it, has a lot to do with being patient as well. I'm going to read just this short little quote from the beginning of that chapter. It just encapsulates it so well. It says, learn to wait well. You're used to getting things in an instant and on demand, but life doesn't always work that way, and neither does God. His timing is rarely yours, but he is always right. He doesn't rush, and he never delays. Instead, he unfolds a plan carefully designed and perfectly timed to bring him glory. Talk more about that and how that's worked in your life.
Can I go ahead, Peter?
Kelly. No, I was thinking that you would go with that because you've written so much on waiting. That's kind of funny how we're both being patient there.
We're both so patient.
Yes. So you go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, just have so many seasons of waiting in my life. I guess I have written quite a bit on my blog, The Sad House. I have many articles on waiting. Had a lot of my friends write their experience of waiting. And I felt like my whole 20s on one level was waiting to get married. You know, there's that. There's waiting for the next life event. And then I was almost 40 before I became a mom. And so that was it felt like a huge season of waiting. And so learning what it means to wait on God has been a huge theme in my life. And it's not something I would say that I've always been very good at. In fact, I've been pretty awful at it. But learned so much through those seasons of what God is doing and the fact that he is, you know, what you read, that quote at the beginning, I have found to be so true and have learned it the hard way as I've been impatient through so many seasons. But Jerome Daly has a quote that he says, waiting is an invitation to intimacy. And I love that. You know, we're just kind of forced to sit with God and to wait on him to do his work and to trust. A lot of waiting well is trusting that God is at work and that his will be done. You know, we can't thwart that. And so being able to trust him in that, and that's really hard. I think we're a generation that we just want things instantaneously. And we're used to that. So much of our life we can get instantaneously. And we have it right at our fingertips, so much of what we want. Yeah. And so I think for our generation and our culture, this is a particularly hard lesson.
Yes, and I mean, the Bible's full of people who are waiting. And then we talk about having the patience of Job. But then in Psalm 40, which is one of my favorites, it says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. And so the people in the Bible, their lives are not always dandy. Their lives don't happen exactly when they want it to happen. David's anointed king, and then he has to run around in the wilderness trying not to get killed by Saul. That's not fun, but it's definitely instructional, and it definitely shapes David into the man he's meant to be. And sometimes we want to get into our 20s, we want to get our career, we want to get rolling, we want to make our money, and that's not necessarily God's plan, because God's got a bigger plan than that. He wants to make us into the men and women that we were designed to be. And in our 20s, quite frankly, in our 30s, our 40s, our 50s, we're never quite there. And so sometimes God has to stop us, so that he can lift us out of the mire and the clay and make us into who he wants to.
Well, that's just a perfect way to wrap up the show. Thank you so much, Peter and Kelly, just for not only writing the book, for taking the time to talk to us about it, and great lessons for people of all ages. I hope your kids will read this when they're in their 20s, will they?
Oh, I hope so.
And then they'll write a book that says, what our parents need to know about us when they're in their 50s.
Yes,
important things to learn.
They'll probably be right. Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you as you continue in your quest to help the 20-somethings that you minister to. They're so lucky to have you, and I just thank you. Blessings on your day and on your next works, whatever they are.
Thank you
so much for having us.
You're welcome. You've been listening to Connecting Faith, and we've just been happy to have you here on the show. If you listen to just part of the broadcast and you want to hear all of it, you can go to our website at myfaithradio.com and click on Connecting Faith. You'll see a list of the podcasts there, and you can send that to someone you think might need to hear it or listen to a variety of others as well. Thanks so much for joining us on Connecting Faith today. Have a great weekend.